Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There are more than 2.3 million confirmed COVID-19 cases in the United States so far. More than 120,000 people have died. While that is a terrible number, it also means that the vast majority of people who get the disease survive and recover. The WHO says recovery time is about 2 weeks for people with mild disease. People with more serious COVID symptoms might suffer for 6 weeks. But for Hannah Davis, it's been even longer than that.
For me, my primary symptoms have been neurological, so I have struggled with memory loss since that day. It's been 91 days.
That's more than 3 months. Hannah is what medical experts are calling a COVID long hauler. She's an artist, lives in Brooklyn, New York. She's 32 and was otherwise healthy when the pandemic first hit. Hannah says she did all of the right things. Her partner is immunocompromised, so they lived in separate spaces for his safety. She stayed home alone as much as possible. But she still had to make occasional trips to the grocery store. Then, on March 25th, Hannah started feeling that something wasn't quite right.
My first symptom was actually that I wasn't able to read a text message. And I didn't realize at the time that's what it was. I just thought I was kind of being scatterbrained and unfocused. And I was like, oh, I must be tired or something. I had elevated temperature. I started getting a cough a little late, like the second, third week. I was worried about concerning my family. And so, especially in the beginning, you know, I was like, oh, I'm sick. It's going to be fine. And it took a while for me to admit how bad it was. I went to the ER twice. The first was in relation to very severe headaches. They came on super suddenly with even just a little bit of stress, either emotional or physical, and they lasted for 3 days. So I went once then, and then I went again when I had 3 nights in a row at night where I was just having difficulty breathing, being woken up because I felt like I couldn't breathe. The first neurologist thought I just had ADHD, which was really disconcerting. I did find a neurologist who has been taking me seriously and is kind of treating it like a traumatic brain injury for just even having a fever for so long, as well as ruling out things like encephalitis. I've been struggling. I've had language issues. I've forgotten words. I've been unable to read. I've been unable to understand what people are saying. And I just couldn't remember some days to make myself breakfast or take a shower or drink water. Like my concentration and my memory is just shot right now. It's very hard to describe. It almost feels just like, you know, not being very present in time and space. I mean, there are times I feel like I'm, you know, slipping from the world and, you know, the medical establishment is totally under-resourced right now. And neurological symptoms in particular have been slow to be reported outside of the kind of early strokes, and the long haulers tend to skew young from what we've seen. I've been just kind of baffled by the amount of doctors that won't just say, I don't know. I'm really hopeful at the kind of emergent community that has come from this. In many cases, we can kind of all crowdsource and understand results way faster just by talking with the, you know, several thousand people who are in the same boat and just not feeling alone and not feeling crazy. My first test was on day 30, and it was just, that's way too late to be tested. For me, a long-term worry is the requirement of the positive test, because it's going to inform what kind of help I can get in the future. It's going to inform what kind of disability I can get in the future. And it needs to be out there that just because someone got a negative test and didn't get antibody tests, that cannot prevent them from getting the help they need. There's a lot of us who aren't kind of being taken seriously and are also in very desperate need of help.
That's Hannah Davis. She's 32 and lives in Brooklyn, New York. She identifies as one of the so-called COVID long haulers. These are people who have been suffering from symptoms of COVID-19 or related to COVID-19 for many months now. And we are going to be taking a look at that and what recovery from COVID-19 looks at over the remainder of this hour. And joining us now, also from Brooklyn, New York, is Dr. Mafazur Rahman, Vice Chair of Medicine at SUNY Downstate Health Sciences University. And Dr. Rahman is also Director of Hospital Medicine and Clinical Assistant Professor in the College of Medicine. He was on the front lines throughout the peak of the pandemic in New York and created a COVID-19 post-discharge clinic. Dr. Rahman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, you've created this COVID discharge clinic for people who obviously had been hospitalized for COVID-19. Why did you feel that there was a need for a clinic to help treat people even after they left the hospital?
So it's actually not uncommon, but at the same time, it's kind of common to see that make the statement that a patient leaves the hospital because they're well enough to go home. But they're really not back to their baseline. We try not to keep patients in the hospital who need just routine care that could be done outside the hospital and would require some significant amount of time. So when we say a patient recovered from COVID in the hospital, COVID-19, and they could be discharged, there is still a long road ahead for those people, those patients, to become normal enough to resume their regular activities, their job, their child caring activities at home, or anything that you may think of normally. And we were seeing a disease that is at the beginning where we're not sure what this virus does. Mm-hmm. So we were learning every day that this virus, we thought initially was a respiratory virus that involved their lungs, and people had breathing issues and cough and a fever, and we thought that was it. But then this quickly panned out into what we're seeing in China and Europe, Italy, Spain, for example, at the beginning. You know, just to give you an idea, in Brooklyn, our peak was about April, mm-hmm. first week of April. So we were seeing patients from and end of February, beginning of March, and we started ramping up. And our real peak in our hospital, particularly at SUNY State University of New York, Downstate Medical Center, was around April. Mm-hmm. So we saw this. And as patients were coming in and they're going home, and we were reading literature, hearing what's happening in other areas, and of course we are looking for directions, what to do about our patients. And we were seeing anecdotal reports, peer reviews, stories about patients who may have issues with their brain, mm-hmm. issues with smell and taste and every other organ you can think of, heart, lungs, kidneys, skin, nerves, neurons. We were thinking, you know what, are we sort of doing the very best we can for our patients? We said they're okay to go home, but what then?
Right.
And especially in a situation where many of the primary care clinics weren't seeing their own patients. They themselves were doing telemedicine, and I am not sure to pick on anybody, but primary care doctors may not have been seeing COVID patients. We were seeing those patients in our hospital, and I thought that it made sense for us to follow up with the same patients because of what we know about the disease, because of what we know about the patients, because we were seeing them in person, to have a better idea of what's going on
yeah.
with them. And we thought it was important for us to have some mechanism set up so that we can continue to do that.
So if I could just jump in here, Dr. Rahman, because you've said
sure.
a lot that's really interesting. First of all, it's probably worthwhile reminding ourselves that this is still a novel disease caused by a novel virus, right? It's only been roughly like 6 or 7 months that it's sort of been known to science and healthcare. So we're learning something every day. But you said that part of the reason why you felt that you needed this post-discharge clinic was that people continued to have symptoms or effects on different organ systems, not just exclusively respiratory. So you have been seeing that? Is that more common than we think?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my God. Thank you for giving the background. I mean, this disease is so new. And viral diseases, at least we doctors, we providers, have some ideas of what happens when a patient contracts a disease and it's a virus that's causing it. But this one, it's sort of every single day, it surprises us that there's some other organ system, some other mechanism, some other presentation it has. I mean, we weren't testing everybody at the beginning. I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic in my area, only patients who are being admitted to the hospital, we're testing them just to see if they have the virus or not. And even that test itself wasn't sufficient, sensitive enough to pick up everybody with the infection. But we're going by symptoms. And if we don't know what symptoms are associated with COVID-19, then we might have been missing patients. And there would have been patients in the community who were told, oh, you just have a regular flu, just go home, just like the patient we listened to had a headache. And I'm sure the doctors were doing the very best they could based on the information they had, and we didn't know that it was necessarily related to COVID-19. It could have been just a simple migraine headache. It could have been something, other things like a lot of people get tension headaches, cluster headaches, for example. It could have been just the lack of sleep, the medications they were taking, stress, so many things.
Yeah.
But now sort of we're learning about this. And in Brooklyn in particular, a lot of our patients are in a very bad situation with a socioeconomic disparity that they may not have primary care doctors. They were not following up with anyone. So for us to have that mechanism of letting these patients be seen and followed up by some provider, some shape or form, we thought was essential for patient care,
right,
for making sure that we just didn't send the patient out of our doors and say, be well, take care of yourself, and God bless. We weren't going to just do that. We needed to make sure that we take care of our patients and at the same time learn,
right,
so that we can be the next example of coming up with, just like you said, are we seeing this? Yes,
yeah,
we are.
Well, Dr. Rahman, I'm going to take it back from you there, because there is a lot more for us to learn here together. And we have to take a quick break, and we'll talk more about it when we come back. So this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about the so-called COVID long haulers. These are people who have been suffering from symptoms of COVID-19 or related to COVID-19. For months now, much longer than, say, the 2 to 3 weeks that mild cases of the disease might lay someone low. I'm joined today by Dr. Mafazur Rahman. He's vice chair of medicine at the State University of New York Downstate Health Sciences University. And he opened up a clinic for COVID-19 patients to come to after they've been discharged from the hospital to keep track and keep taking care of folks who have these lingering symptoms after they've left the hospital. And if you're one of those people, maybe even if you were never hospitalized, but if you're a so-called COVID-19 long hauler, what have your symptoms been like? What has that felt like? How long have you been suffering for? And what should we talk about when we talk about what recovering from COVID actually means? So head over to social media at Twitter or Facebook. We're at On Point Radio in both of those spaces, and let us know what your experience has been like. Dr. Rahman, if you can just stand by for a moment, I now want to bring in Ed Yong. He is the science writer for The Atlantic, and his latest piece is called COVID-19 Can Last for Several Months. He's written exhaustively on this pandemic, basically since the get-go. Ed Yong, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Okay, so Ed, so long haul, what are we talking about here? I mean, because most people, I think, when they think of recovering from COVID, it's that, you know, 2 to 3 week period that we've been talking about for several months.
Yeah, that's definitely the caricature of the disease. But the reality is often much more complicated. As we heard from Hannah, and as I've heard from about a dozen other people, even so-called mild cases, people who've never been severely sick enough to actually be hospitalized, can experience many months of rolling, incapacitating symptoms that severely hamper their lives and stop them from doing their daily activities, but that haven't meant that they require ventilation or intubation. So I think understanding this greatly changes our perspective, our understanding of what a so-called mild case might be, and what it might mean to have COVID, even if you don't actually die from the disease.
Mm. And in the people that you spoke to, were they describing the same kinds of symptoms that Hannah did about, for example, a lot of sort of mental status changes, or at least a sense of fogginess and unreliability mm-hmm. of their brains?
Yeah, so brain fogs, concentration problems, these are all very common. There are a lot of other symptoms too. Extreme fatigue is very, very common, especially fatigue that kind of exacerbates after any form of mild physical activity. There are also all sorts of other things, GI symptoms, the usual respiratory symptoms. My sister-in-law has been spiking a fever for several months now. The symptoms are varied. They roll, they change unpredictably. But you do see large overall consistent patterns among this community of thousands of people who really haven't had access to medical care.
Dr. Rahman, let me turn to you there. Do we have the beginnings of the understanding of why this may be, even like a rudimentary understanding? Is it that the virus just dwells in other body systems longer or what?
So I think it's what Ed is talking about and what the patient actually described is a brain fog. And a lot of these issues, it's not just this coronavirus, the novel coronavirus that we're talking about, other Epstein-Barr viruses, viruses that cause Q fever, mm-hmm. for example. It's well known that maybe about 10% of the patients who recover from viral illnesses sometimes have long-standing complications. And these complications mm-hmm. can be mild to the point that patients don't recognize it. They just recognize that they're just a bit tired, so they just don't exert themselves as much, to the point of patients who can't be functional anymore. And these kind of symptoms can last for months, years. Sometimes what we have in myalgic encephalopathy or chronic fatigue syndrome in patients who have these type of symptoms for more than 6 months, for example, we do see that, and we are seeing it. So it's not just this virus alone that we think can do this. Viruses generally, bacterial infections, can have long-standing complications for patients, and that is a very, very important point for our patient population to understand that, yes, you do get over the disease, but you do get over to what state? Maybe 50% of your pre-COVID lifestyle, 60%, 70%. You may never get to be 100% like you. This never happened to you. If people realize that, I think that's a very, very important step in trying to stop or prevent the dissemination of this disease. Young people particularly think, oh, yeah, nothing happens to us. But nothing's happening to the children. We, at the beginning, we clinicians kind of were happy that, you know what, children don't get the disease, because we kind of had a short-sighted view that COVID virus, if you're exposed to it, within 14 days you develop symptoms, and if you don't get bad disease within 14 days or so, you're kind of clear. Kids don't get symptoms during that phase, so we were happy. But then we found out, you know what, in about 2 months or so, 8 weeks, 10 weeks later, kids are getting very, very sick. The multisystem inflammatory syndrome in children, it's happening 2 months after being exposed. So it's not the virus itself that's causing the disease. It's what, in medical term, we call cytokine storm. The body's immune system, which is actually a very, very important part of defense mechanism protecting patients from diseases. At early on, people get fever, they don't feel well, they rest a little bit, the body's fighting the disease. That's great. That's important. It's really necessary. But when that defense system becomes overactive, overtakes the body, creates all those cytokine, the chemicals in the body that helps fight an infection, that system itself then turns on the body itself. And that's where you start seeing long-standing complications that children were having that we're seeing. So we know that we should be expecting complications. We should be expecting some parts of our patients, a significant portion of our patients, to have lingering effects.
Yeah.
And if we don't ask those patients those questions that medical providers should be asking, we might not be eliciting them. And if we don't watch out for symptoms, we might not be discovering, yeah, identifying related symptoms.
So let me turn back to Ed on this, because this is so fascinating. Once again, just to remind us, we didn't have a crystal ball when the novel coronavirus first came onto the scene, so that we're learning as we go. But Dr. Rahman was talking about something really important there, that so far in the arc of humanity managing this pandemic, there's been a certain framework of how we approach it, right? Like the asymptomatic, that 14-day time period, et cetera. But now what both of you seem to be saying is that framework needs to be radically adjusted. We need to rethink what it means to not just be infected, but to recover from this disease, Ed.
Absolutely. We have this tendency to dichotomize things, to turn things into very stark binaries. So you either survive or die from the virus. You either have a severe or mild case. What we're learning is that a lot of what we would previously have called mild is actually terrible. It was really incapacitating. And a lot of people who don't die from the virus still endure months of symptoms that they still need to survive. That being a survivor is not just an all clear path back to perfect health. And I think we really need to grapple with that. I think Dr. Rahman is absolutely right in noting that other viral infections and other diseases have led to similar waves of symptoms before, and conditions that present in similar ways, like ME or chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, those people with those conditions have long been dismissed. They've been told that the diseases aren't real, that they're making things up, that their symptoms are all in their head. Research into these conditions have long been underfunded. And as a result, now when we have this pandemic and untold numbers of patients, thousands, maybe tens of thousands, who are presenting with very similar problems, we really are still in the dark about how to both prevent these from progressing on to something like ME, and we don't know ways of treating and helping these patients. And I think that is a wholly preventable tragedy that could have been avoided had people with similar problems not been kind of gaslit and disbelieved for many decades.
Well, so let me ask you, though, for the sake of scientific rigor, and Dr. Rahman, I'll turn this to you. You heard Hannah describe her story at the beginning of this program. She got tested finally on day 30. From the beginning of the onset of her symptoms, day 30, so a month later. And at that time, she tested negative, because I guess it was so long from the start of the beginning of symptoms. So technically speaking, she has never tested positive for COVID-19. So two questions there. First, is it possible that people like Hannah, that the source of their illness could be something else?
I think it's always possible. Nothing is 100% in medicine. But you have to start thinking about the quality of the test and the type of test that we're thinking of. Initially, we were doing this PCR, nasal oropharyngeal swabs, and they were not capturing all of the patients who actually had the virus. Subsequently, we, as in everybody in medicine, Department of Health in New York State, New York City, and other agencies, have been trying to sort of troubleshoot, try to figure out tests that would catch patients. Mm-hmm. They had to set up a threshold at what antibody titers somebody would be considered positive and somebody would be considered negative. So we were learning. So I myself got tested one time with the antibodies with the New York State Department of Health protocol, and I came back negative. At that time, believe it or not, even patients who were initially tested to be positive with having the virus in their nasopharyngeal swabs, tested and had symptoms, tested negative with antibodies. So this particular patient might have been one of the unfortunate ones who were sort of this false negatives category both times. So we are learning that, yes, patients might have tested negative either with the PCR test or the antibody test, but they still could have symptoms that are atypical symptoms. Those themselves might still represent the COVID-19.
I see. Well, so,
and we're keeping our minds open, yes.
So Ed, Hannah told us more about this. She, you know, just to remind folks, she's in Brooklyn, New York, so obviously one of the major epicenters, New York City, for the pandemic in the United States. And as a reminder, she wasn't able to get tested until day 30 of her symptoms. So that was well into April. And here's what she told us.
The day that is best to get tested on is day 3 of symptoms. And that day even still has a 1 in 5 false negative rate. And after that day, it continues to go down. So by day 21, 2/3 of tests are false negatives. That is just not something that is being reported at all. And it's particularly bad right now because we're starting to see clinics for long haulers, but they're requiring a positive test. And that particularly, I mean, that hurts everyone who's gotten a false negative, but that particularly hurts the thousands of people who got sick like I did in March when there wasn't access to testing.
So, Ed, first of all, what Hannah says there about the false negative rate going up the longer into the period of symptoms that one waits, is that right?
She's absolutely right. When you get tested so far after the onset of symptoms, like she and many other long haulers have, again, because of this medical dismissal, it's much more less likely that you're actually going to have a positive test, even if you previously were infected. But there is a really interesting data point here that Hannah herself helped to create. She's not just a long hauler. She's also part of a research team of long haulers who have studied their own health and symptoms. They did a survey of, I think it's over 640 people who fit this bill. And they found that only half of them had managed to get tested. And of those, half again got positive tests and half got negative ones. But if you compare those two groups, you see exactly the same pattern of symptoms presenting over time on average. So it's clear that the long haulers who have got the surety of a positive COVID diagnosis through tests have the same set of symptoms as the ones who are testing negative. And I think that substantiates what Hannah and what Dr. Rahman have said, that the tests, even when they turn up negative, are not an all clear. They don't mean you didn't have the virus. And it's all part of this muddle of confusion and uncertainty that people with these long-lasting symptoms are experiencing. Right. And I think that research project that they did is such an important part of the picture. It's the patients themselves taking their own care and their own health into their own hands and presenting really vital information that people need to be aware of.
Well, and then Hannah also brings up a very important point about the sort of awful in-between space that many of these long haulers find themselves in, because if they don't actually have a positive test, you know, she was saying that it might be hard to get the kind of treatment they need, maybe insurance coverage for it, or possibly even in some of these new clinics. So, Dr. Rahman, did you want to respond to that?
I mean, that's definitely a possibility. It's being a novel disease, like you mentioned before, there are things that we don't know. So somehow we'll have to advocate, yes, tests are not gold standard. They don't catch 100% of the patients who have a headed disease because they themselves are in experimental. The tests are in the testing phase, trying to figure out if they will catch a disease. What do we call a positive? What do we call a negative test? We don't know yet. We're figuring this out. But Ed said, when you start doing studies and you follow patients with positive tests and look at their timeline and their symptomatology, and you have patients who are negative and you look at their symptomatology, and when they coincide and they're essentially the same, we might have to call that a positive test, a false negative test, but we have to call it a COVID-19 POI, person under investigation, or POI, person with the symptoms. We'll have to call all those patients that. And I think insurance companies and the society itself needs to recognize that there are significant limitations, especially in a pandemic this huge, where resources are limited and studies are, you know, people are doing studies. We have professors and clinicians doing studies all over the world. Sometimes we are finding out that they're flawed. They are not correct. They're publishing data that's incorrect. They're trying to be helpful, trying to rush up studies without the proper diligence, without randomized controlled trials. So what do we know?
Well,
we know
Doctor, Dr. Rahman, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take it back from you there because we have to take our next break here. But the question of what do we know, that's something that we're going to keep coming back to, right, why we're doing in part these hours and talking to folks like you and Ed. So Dr. Mafasur Rahman, Vice Chair of Medicine at the SUNY Downstate Health Sciences University, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about COVID long haulers, or people who suffer from symptoms of COVID-19 for weeks and months on end. I'm joined today by Ed Yong. He's science writer for The Atlantic, and his latest piece is COVID-19 Can Last for Several Months. We've got links to that at onpointradio.org. Ed, I just want to ask you a quick question here about Dr. Rahman touched on this earlier, but some theories as to why this might happen, why people might have these waves of recurrent symptoms for many months. Is it because do we think it could be because the virus still remains in the body, or the immune system is so primed that it just doesn't stop its ongoing reactions?
I think it's more likely the latter. We don't want to rule anything out.
Right.
There have been other viruses that have been known to hide out in reservoirs in the body and then sort of pop up again. But I suspect that it's more likely to do with that lingering immune overreaction. But I think the honest answer is we really don't know. There are so many uncertainties about not just this new coronavirus, because as you say, it is very new, but also just the aftermath of viral infections more generally. I think that is broadly an under-researched area. And, you know, we're seeing the costs of that lack of attention now.
Right. And it just adds so many more questions to already a confusing and uncertain state, right? Because people are told, well, don't go back to work or self-isolate for 14 days, or once you're clear of symptoms for 14 days, you can presume some kind of normalcy. But if we're talking about recurrent waves coming over many months, at what point in time is a person deemed healthy enough to return to their normal life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is really hard to overstate the emotional toll that these waves of symptoms have on the people who experience them. You know, not only are they experiencing these mental problems that they a lot of them can't do anything in their daily lives, you know, the types of things that other people have enjoyed during lockdowns, baking, reading, a lot of the long haulers can't do any of that. And on top of that, their disease is so different to the standard picture that many of them doubt themselves. They start wondering if they've made up their own symptoms. A lot of them face disbelief from their friends, their families, their doctors. You know, they're told that maybe they just have anxiety or in Hannah's case, ADHD. Mm-hmm. They're told that maybe they're just stressed. These are people who are struggling to breathe, who are, you know, having memory loss problems, and they're being told that they're stressed. A lot of them are women. That kind of gaslighting disproportionately affects women, and we're seeing that in this case. And they just don't have the certainty of knowing what is going to happen to them. And I think it's a horrible situation, and it's not helped by the fact that they are overlooked as part of the COVID narrative. You know, they're not counted in, a lot of them aren't counted in case counts. They're not counted in deaths or hospitalizations. And they're sort of being left out of the debate. So I'm glad that OnPoint is giving airtime to this. I think it's really, really important.
Well, you talked about your sister-in-law a couple of minutes ago, Ed, and that she's been having basically a recurrent fever, if I can put it that way, with only a few normal days of normal body temperature reading. And so, I mean, virtually every institution I know of says if you have a fever, you've got to stay home. So what has that done to her life if she hasn't had lots of normal temperature readings?
Yeah, so her local health department said that as long as she has a fever, she is, you know, being treated as contagious and asked to self-isolate. So, yeah, she was stuck at home for several months. I think things have got better recently, but you know, it's not a good place to be. Some people have said that that experience of being in prolonged isolation, not just the kind of quarantine loneliness that most of us who stayed at home felt, but also, you know, the extra isolation of having to stay in bed, like being unable to do any of your daily activities. In many ways, it kind of recapitulates the experience of being depressed. You know, you're in this enclosed space. You can't do what feels normal. It's bad. It's really bad.
Well, Ed, hang on here for just a second, because I now want to bring in OnPoint producer Dori Scheimer. She produced this hour, and she's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, monitoring what's the feedback we're getting from listeners on social media. So hello, Dori.
Hi. Lots of comments on social media. And one from Brett from our website kind of captures what we're hearing from a lot of people. And he wants to know, how much permanent damage, you know, do we know about COVID in the recovery? How many people are suffering from long-term or lifelong impacts from getting the disease?
So the honest answer is we don't know. You know, as we've heard already, this is a virus that we didn't know even existed until about 6 months ago. So to know what proportion of people will progress to long-term disability, it's honestly an open question. We know some worrying signs from past coronavirus epidemics like the original SARS, but a lot of the evidence that we have now comes from clinical studies of people who have had severe cases, who have been on intubated, who've been in ICUs for a long time. What we don't really understand is what happens to folks like Hannah, who have not been hospitalized. hospitalized, but who still endured these months of symptoms. One thing I will say that I think is really important, a lot of the people I spoke to, a lot of the long haulers, say that they have tried to push through it, that they have this this very understandable feeling that if they're just exhausted, you know, they can't just stay in bed all of the time. They need to start getting fit, getting back into exercise. A lot of them were previously healthy and fit and active. And whenever they've tried to do that, it has often made things a lot worse. Like, activity tends to bring crashes. And that is a common thing that we see among the ME community and among a lot of people with chronic illnesses. So I think for people who are in this camp, who are experiencing these months of prolonged symptoms, I'm not a medical doctor, but what I've heard from those who are and those who have experienced this is that rest is really, really important in that early phase.
So just, Ed, since you mentioned ME a couple of times, you're talking about myalgic encephalomyelitis.
That's right.
Did I say it correctly?
I think you did.
Okay. I just wanted to, because acronyms are the bane of all of us here. Dori, do you have more comments from social media?
Yeah, Michael on Facebook said he's been having additional symptoms for the past 3 weeks. In early May, he says he had symptoms of fever, fatigue, and a little runny nose over 5 days. My hospital test results for COVID were reported by phone as negative, but were entered into the hospital record as not determined. Has Ed seen this itchy skin in other suspected COVID-19 recovering patients?
So certain people definitely have had skin problems. I've heard everything from prickling and tingling sensations in the skin to a feeling as if your skin was almost vibrating when you touched surfaces. And this sort of feels consistent with some of the neurological symptoms that we've already talked about, the brain fogs, the lack of concentration, that, you know, the idea that this is a disease that also attacks the sympathetic nervous system, which controls a lot of really basic, automatic processes like heartbeats and breathing. It all seems to be part of a picture of a virus that does more than just attack the respiratory symptom. But, you know, beyond that, like Dr. Raman said, I think we're still sadly in the early days of figuring out exactly how this disease presents, what the long-term consequences are, and indeed how it is or is not similar to other post-viral illnesses that we've known about.
So, Ed, about this being post-viral, you know, the entire world is looking forward to a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. Mm-hmm. Presumably, when that vaccine comes, there's a possibility that it may not help people who are COVID long haulers, right? If it's not directly the virus that's causing their post-viral symptoms, right?
Yeah, so, you know, a vaccine is meant to... the vaccine that we're trying to create is intended to stop people from getting infected in the first place. It's not going to be a treatment for those who have already endured an assault from the virus and are now dealing with the consequences of that. Finding treatments for this long hauler presentation is going to be really important. I hope we see more research for that. I hope that that research then also provides benefit for the ME community, for people with other kinds of similar chronic illnesses. It's high time that we had more attention paid to that. And, you know, I'm hoping that this is part of, part of a solution. It's sad that it shouldn't have taken a pandemic to make people care about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we're having this conversation. Also, I'm mindful of the fact that we're seeing infection rates go up in the United States and precipitously in some states. I mean, Dori, you're there in Pittsburgh right now. Give us a sense of what's happening on the ground, for example, in Pittsburgh. What have you seen?
Yeah, I've seen a big difference. I spent most of the time in Boston and just here for a little while, and I cannot believe how open it is. So Pittsburgh, Allegheny County is in level green, which means that almost all businesses are open. Restaurants are at about 50% capacity, and they've now been in that phase since the beginning of June, June 5th. And in the past week or so, they're reporting an increased number of cases. So 37 new cases of COVID-19 today. And that's double or almost triple what they were just a couple of weeks ago.
And it seems to me, looking at some of the data from there, that many of the cases are amongst younger people or people below the age of 40.
Right. And that, I mean, that is not surprising to me. I took a drive around the city last night and, you know, the areas with restaurants and businesses, there's lots of people. Most people, I would say, aren't wearing masks. There's even been some controversy at a couple of restaurants where customers are saying, I'm expecting your wait staff to wear masks. And the business owner is saying, well, go somewhere else then. I'm not requiring masks in my business.
So, Ed, the reason why I wanted to have Dori give us a little reporting from where she is especially regarding the age of people that we're seeing in these new COVID infections. That seems to overlap a little bit with what we've seen with the long haulers. That there's a lot of people sort of in that under 40 group that are suffering from the long haul symptoms.
That's right. Most of the people I've spoken to who have these symptoms are in that quite young age category. In that survey that I spoke about that Hannah and her colleagues did of, 640 long haulers, the majority were in the 30 to 49 age group. So this, the idea that this is a disease that only badly affects the very elderly, and that if you're young, you're fine and you'll get away with a cold, is just very inaccurate. Your risk of having severe enough a disease to be hospitalized or dying is higher if you're older. But that doesn't mean that the young are invincible. So many of the people I've spoken to were, in the peak of health, had no pre-existing conditions, were very active runners, ate healthily. And yet, for reasons that are still completely unclear, have, faced these months of debilitating symptoms. I think that if we understood this better, as someone who is in that age group myself, it has really changed my calculus of of my own risk. I wasn't doing risky things before, but I really am not going to do them now, because I think I just have a very different understanding of what the virus can do to people who are like me.
But part of the persistent problem here that I'm hearing, Ed, is that, we have that more in the United States, more than 2.3 million confirmed COVID cases. We have those 120,000 deaths, right? So there's two poles here. And what's happening in the middle, and these long haulers are in the middle, we don't have a really good picture of that because for multiplicity reasons, one of them is the testing that we've talked about. So we don't even know how many people might be suffering from COVID long haul symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. It is shocking that a country as well resourced and rich and biomedically powerful as the US should so utterly fail in testing, should so utterly fail in working out how many of its citizens are sick. That is ridiculous. And you're right that the standard statistics we used to tell the stories of this pandemic are not capturing a lot of the story. So we talk about cases, we talk about deaths and hospitalizations. That leaves out a ton of people, including Hannah and thousands of others, who are affected by COVID-19 or something else that is presenting in almost exactly the same way, and who are suffering but who aren't being counted. And I think it's such an important reminder that ties into what Dr. Rahman said about the testing. Like, every statistic both ignores and illuminates, and we're seeing the consequences of the people who are being ignored now.
Well, Ed Yong is a science writer for The Atlantic. His latest piece is COVID-19 can last for several months. Ed, it is always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Dori Scheimer, On Point producer, thank you for bringing us the news from Pittsburgh. Thanks, Dori.
Thank you.
And we've got links to Ed's reporting at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.